So she took you everywhere with her? Sophie asked, genuinely fascinated. Yes, we lived the gypsy life until my teenage years when we settled down in California. Was it lonely for you? Well, it was all I knew, so it seemed normal to me. I got to know the back rooms of suburban strip mall restaurants very well, and I was pretty much a bookworm. And what about your father? He died soon after I was born. Oh, I'm sorry, Sophie said quickly, regretting that she had asked. That's fine. I never knew him. Rachel smiled, trying to put her at ease. And anyway, it wasn't all bad. My mom put herself through night school, got a college degree, and has been a successful real estate agent for many years now. That's amazing, Sophie said. Not really. We're actually one of the many cliched Asian immigrant success stories that politicians love to trot out every 4 years during their conventions. Sophie chuckled. I can see why Nick likes you. You both have the same dry wit. Rachel smiled, looking away toward the disco marquee on the jetty. My keeping you from the dance party? I hear Araminta flew in some famous DJ from Ibiza, Sophie said. I'm enjoying this, actually. It's the first real conversation I've had all day. Sophie glanced at the girls, most of whom were now writhing wildly with several of the Italian waiters to the pounding Euro-trance disco music, and shrugged. Well, with this crowd, I can't say I'm surprised. Aren't these your friends? A few, but most of these girls, I don't know. I recognize them, of course. Who are they? Are some of them famous? In their own minds, perhaps. These are the more social girls, the type that are always appearing in the magazines, attending all the charity galas. Far too glamorous a crowd for me. I'm sorry, but I work 12-hour shifts and don't have the time to go to benefit parties in hotels. I have to benefit my patients first. Rachel laughed. Speaking of which, Sophie added, I've been up since 5, so I'm going to turn in now. I think I will too, Rachel said. They walked down the jetty toward their bungalows. I'm in the villa at the end of this walkway if you need anything, Sophie said. Good night, Rachel said. It's been lovely talking with you. Likewise, Sophie said, flashing that deep, dimpled smile again. Rachel entered her villa, gladly returning to some peace and quiet after a draining day. None of the lights were on in the suite, but the bright silvery moonlight glimmered through the open screen doors, casting serpentine ripples along the walls. The sea was so still that the sound of the water lapping slowly against the wood stilts had a hypnotic effect. It was the perfect setting for a night swim in the ocean, something she'd never done. Rachel padded toward the bedroom for her bikini. As she passed the vanity table, she noticed that the leather satchel she'd left hanging on the chair seemed to be leaking some sort of liquid. She walked toward the bag and saw that it was completely drenched, with brownish water dripping out of the corner into a large puddle on the bedroom floor. What the hell happened? She turned on the lamp by the table and opened the front flap of her bag. She screamed, jerking backward in horror and knocking over the table lamp. Her bag was filled with a large fish that had been badly mutilated, blood seeping out from its gills. Violently scrawled on the vanity mirror above the chair in fish blood were the words, "Catch this, you gold-digging cunt!" Chapter 12. Eleanor. Shenzhen. 30,000 yuan? That's ridiculous! Eleanor seethed at the man in the poly-blend gray jacket seated across from her in the lounge off the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton. The man looked around to make sure that Eleanor's outburst wasn't attracting too much attention. Trust me, it will be worth your money, the man said quietly in Mandarin. Mr. Wong, how can we be sure your information has any value when we don't even know what it is exactly? Lorena asked. Listen, your brother explained to Mr. Tin what the situation was, and Mr. Tin and I go way back. I have worked for him for more than 20 years. We are the best at this sort of thing. Now, I'm not sure what exactly you're planning, and I don't want to know, but I can assure you that this information will be extremely beneficial to whoever possesses it, Mr. Wong said confidently. Lorena translated his response for Eleanor. Who does he think we are? There isn't any sort of information that's worth 30,000 yuan to me. Does he think I'm made of money? Eleanor was indignant. How
about 15,000?
Lorena asked.
Okay, for you, 20,000, Mr. Wong countered. 15,000 and that's our last offer,
Lorena insisted again.
Okay, 17,500, but that's my last offer,
the man said, getting frustrated by all the bargaining. Mr. Tin had told him that these ladies were millionaires.
No, 10,000 or I leave,
Eleanor suddenly declared in Mandarin. The man glared at her as if she had insulted all of his ancestors. He shook his head in dismay.
Lorena, I'm done with this extortion,
Eleanor huffed, getting up from her red velvet club chair. Lorena stood up as well, and both women began to walk out of the lounge into the soaring three-story atrium lobby, where there was a sudden traffic jam of men in tuxedos and women in black, white, and red ball gowns.
Must be some sort of big function going on, Eleanor noted,
scrutinizing a woman ablaze with diamonds around her neck.
Shenzhen is not Shanghai, that's for sure. All these women are dressed in fashions from 3 years ago,
Lorena observed wryly as she tried to navigate her way through the crowd.
Eleanor, I think you've gone too far with your bargaining tactics this time. I think we've lost this guy. Lorena, trust me, keep walking and don't turn around, Eleanor instructed.
Just as the ladies reached the front entrance of the hotel, Mr. Wong suddenly came running out of the lounge.
Okay, okay, 10,000, he said breathlessly.
Eleanor beamed in triumph as she followed the man back to the table. Mr. Wong made a quick phone call on his cell and then said to the ladies,
Okay, my informer will be here very soon. Until then, what would you ladies like to drink?
Lorena was a little surprised to hear this. She had assumed that they would be taken to some other place to meet the informer.
Is it safe to meet right here?
Why not?
This is one of the best hotels in Shenzhen.
I mean, it's so public.
Don't worry. You'll see that it will be just fine,
Mr. Wong said, grabbing a handful of macadamia nuts from the silver bowl on the table. A few minutes later, a man entered the bar, walking with trepidation toward their table. Eleanor could tell just by looking at him that he was from some rural area and that it was the first time he had set foot in a hotel as fancy as this. He wore a striped polo shirt and ill-fitting dress pants and carried a metallic silver briefcase. It looked to Lorena like he had just picked up the suitcase an hour ago from one of those cheap luggage stalls at the train station to make himself seem more professional. He looked nervously at the women as he approached the table. Mr. Wong had a short exchange with him in a dialect that neither woman could understand, and the man set his briefcase onto the granite top table. He fiddled with the combination and clicked the locks on each side in unison before opening the briefcase lid ceremoniously. The man took out three items from the suitcase and placed them on the table in front of the ladies. There was a small rectangular paper box, a manila envelope, and one photocopy of a newspaper clipping. Lorena opened the manila envelope and fished out a yellowed piece of paper while Eleanor opened the box. She peered into it and then looked at the piece of paper Lorena was holding. She only read very basic Mandarin, so she was mystified by it.
What does all this mean?
Just give me a minute to finish, Elle,
Lorena said, scanning the last document up and down.
Oh my God, Elle,
she exclaimed, suddenly staring at Mr. Wong and the informer.
Are you sure this is completely accurate? There will be big trouble for all of you if it isn't.
I swear on the life of my firstborn son,
the man replied haltingly.
What is it? What is it?
Eleanor asked urgently, hardly able to contain herself. Lorena whispered into Eleanor's right ear. Her eyes grew large and she looked up at Mr. Wong.
Mr. Wong, I'll give you 30,000 yen in cash if you can take me right now,
Eleanor commanded. Chapter 13. Rachel. Samsara Island. Sophie was splashing some water on her face when she heard an urgent rapping. She went to the door and found Rachel standing there, her lips white and her whole body shaking.
What's wrong? Are you cold?
Sophie asked.
I think I'm in shock,
Rachel stuttered.
What? What happened?
My room. I can't describe it. Go see for yourself, Rachel said numbly.
Are you okay? Should I call for help?
No, I'll be fine. I'm just shaking involuntarily. Sophie immediately slipped into doctor mode, grabbing hold of Rachel's wrist.
Your pulse is a bit elevated, she noted.
She grabbed the cashmere throw on her chaise lounge and handed it to Rachel.
Sit down. Take long, slow breaths. Wrap this around yourself and wait right here, she instructed.
A few minutes later, Sophie returned to the villa, ablaze in anger.
I can't believe it. This is outrageous.
Rachel nodded slowly, having calmed down a little by this point. Can you call hotel security for me?
Of course.
Sophie headed for the phone and scanned the list on it, looking for the right button to press. She turned back to Rachel and gave her a thoughtful look.
Actually, I'm wondering whether it's the best idea to call security.
What exactly could they do?
We can find out who did this. There's security cameras everywhere, and surely they must have footage of who went into my room, Rachel said.
Well, what would that really achieve? Sophie ventured.
Hear me out for a second. No one's committed any real crime. I mean, I feel bad for the fish, and it was certainly traumatizing for you. But if you think about it, this was just a nasty prank. We're on an island. We know it had to be one of these girls, or maybe even a group of them. Do you really care who did it? Are you going to confront someone and make a scene? They're just trying to mess with you. Why give them more fuel? I'm sure they're on the beach right now just waiting for you to go hysterical and ruin Araminta's bachelorette party. They wanted to provoke you.
Rachel considered what Sophie had said for a moment. You know, you're right. I'm sure these girls are just dying for some drama so they can talk about it back in Singapore. She got up from the sofa and paced around the room, not quite sure what to do next.
But there must be something we can do.
Doing nothing can sometimes be the most effective form of action, Sophie remarked. If you do nothing, you'll be sending a clear message that you're stronger than they think you are, not to mention a lot classier. Think about it.
Rachel mulled it over for a few minutes and decided that Sophie was right. Did anyone ever tell you how brilliant you are, Sophie? She said with a sigh.
Sophie smiled.
Here, I saw some Vervain tea in the bathroom. Let me make some. It'll calm both our nerves.
With warm cups of tea nestled on their laps, Rachel and Sophie sat on a pair of lounge chairs on the deck. The moon hung like a giant gong in the sky, lighting the ocean so brightly that Rachel could see the tiny schools of fish shimmering as they darted around the wooden piers of the bungalow. Sophie looked intently at Rachel.
You weren't prepared for any of this, were you? Astra was so perceptive when she asked me to look out for you. She was a little worried about you tagging along with this particular crowd.
Astrid is so sweet. I guess I just never expected to encounter this kind of viciousness, that's all. The way these girls are acting, it's as if Nick is the last man in all of Asia. Look, I get it now. His family's rich. He's considered a good catch. But isn't Singapore supposed to be filled with other rich families like his?
Sophie sighed sympathetically. First of all, Nick is so inordinately good-looking. Most of these girls have had mad crushes on him since childhood. Then you have to understand something about his family. There's a certain mystique that surrounds them because they are so intensely private. Most people don't even realize they exist, but for the small circle of old families that do, they inspire a level of fascination that's hard to describe. Nick is the scion of this noble clan, and for some of these girls, that's all that matters. They may not know the first thing about him, but they're all vying to become Mrs. Nicholas Young.
Rachel took it all in quietly. It felt like Sophie was talking about some character of fiction, someone who bore no resemblance to the man she knew and had fallen in love with. It was as if she were a Sleeping Beauty, only she never asked to be awakened by a prince. You know, Nick has told me very little about his family. I still don't know much about them, Rachel mused.
That's the way Nick was raised. I'm sure he was taught from a very young age never to talk about his family, where he lived, that sort of thing. He was brought up in such a cloistered environment. Can you imagine growing up in that house with no other kids around? No one but your parents, grandparents, and all those servants? I remember going over there as a child, and Nick always seemed so grateful whenever there were other kids to play with.
Rachel gazed at the moon. Suddenly, the rabbit-like figure on the moon reminded her of Nick, a little boy stuck up there in that glittering palace all by himself. Do you want to know the craziest part of all this?
Tell me.
I just came for a summer vacation. Everyone here assumes that Nick and I are a done deal, that we're going to run off and tie the knot tomorrow or something. Nobody knows that marriage is something we've never even discussed.
Really? You haven't?
Sophie asked in surprise.
But don't you ever think about it? Don't you want to marry Nick?
To be completely honest, Nick is the first guy I've dated who I could imagine being married to. But I was never raised to believe that marriage was supposed to be my life's goal. My mother wanted me to get the best education first. She never wanted me to end up having to wash dishes in a restaurant. That's not the case over here. No matter how advanced we become, there's still tremendous pressure for girls to get married. Here, it doesn't matter how successful a woman is professionally. She isn't considered complete until she's married and has children. Why do you think Araminta's so eager to get married?
Do you think Araminta shouldn't be getting married then?
Well, that's a difficult question for me to answer. I mean, she is about to become my sister-in-law.
Rachel looked at Sophie in surprise.
Wait a minute. Colin is your brother?
Yes, Sophie giggled. I thought you knew that all along.
Rachel stared at her with renewed wonder.
I had no idea. I thought you were Astrid's cousin.
So the Koos are related to the Leongs?
Yes, of course. My mother was born a Leong. She was Harry Leong's sister.
Rachel noticed that Sophie used the past tense in talking about her mother. Is your mother no longer around?
She passed away when we were kids. She had a heart attack.
Oh, Rachel said, realizing why she felt a connection with the girl she had met only hours earlier. Don't take this the wrong way, but I understand now why you're so different from the other girls.
Sophie smiled. Growing up with only one parent, especially in a place where everyone goes to such great lengths to present a picture-perfect family, really sets you apart. I was always the girl whose mother died too young. But you know, it had its advantages. It allowed me to get away from the frying pan. After my mum died, I was sent to school in Australia, and I stayed there all through uni. I suppose that's what makes me a little different.
A lot different, Rachel corrected. She thought of another thing that made her like Sophie. Her candor and complete lack of pretension reminded her so much of Nick. Rachel peered up at the moon, and this time, the rabbit boy didn't look so alone anymore. Chapter 14 Astrid and Michael, Singapore. The minute Harry Leong's Armani-suited security men entered her hospital room and did their usual sweep, Astrid knew that she had been found out. Minutes later, her parents rushed into the room in a huff.
Astrid, are you okay? How's Cassian? Where is he?
Her mother asked anxiously.
I'm fine, I'm fine. Michael is with Cassian in the children's ward signing his release forms.
Astrid's father eyed the elderly Chinese woman a few feet away, vigorously rubbing tiger balm onto her ankle.
Why did they bring you to a public hospital? And why on earth are you not in your own room? I'm going to tell them to move you immediately,
Harry whispered irritatedly.
It's okay, Daddy. I had a slight concussion, so they just put me in this ward for monitoring. Like I said, we're about to get released.
How did you know I was here?
Astrid demanded, not bothering to hide her annoyance.
Ayo, you've been in the hospital for 2 days without telling us, and all you care about is how we found out,
Felicity sighed.
Don't get so kanchiong, Mum. Nothing happened. Nothing happened? Cassandra called up at 7 this morning from England. She scared us half to death, making it sound like you were Princess Diana in that tunnel in Paris,
Felicity lamented.
Just be glad she didn't call the Straits Times, Harry added.
Astrid rolled her eyes. Radio 1 Asia had struck again. How in the world did Cassandra know about her accident? She had specifically told the ambulance driver to take her to General Hospital, not one of the private hospitals like Mount Elizabeth or Glen Eagles, so that she might avoid being recognized. Of course, that hadn't worked.
This is it. You are no longer allowed to drive. You are going to get rid of that lousy Japanese car of yours, and I am going to assign Yusuf to you from now on.
He can use one of the Vandenpla, Harry declared.
Stop treating me like a 6-year-old, Daddy. It was such a minor accident. My concussion was from the airbag, that's all.
The fact that your airbag deployed means that the accident was more serious than you think. If you don't value your life, do as you wish. But I'm not going to let you put my grandson's life in danger. What's the use of having all these drivers when no one uses them? Yusuf will drive Cassian from now on, Harry insisted.
Daddy, Cassian only got a few cuts.
Ayaw, a few cuts, Felicity sighed, shaking her head in dismay, just as Michael entered the room with Cassian.
Oh, Cassian, my poor darling, she exclaimed, rushing toward the child, who was happily clutching a red balloon.
Where the hell were you on Friday night? Harry barked at his son-in-law. If you were doing your proper duty escorting her, this wouldn't have happened.
Daddy, stop it, Astrid cut in.
I was working late, sir, Michael said as calmly as possible.
Working late, working late. You're always working late these days, aren't you? Harry muttered contemptuously.
Enough, Daddy. We're leaving now. Come on, Michael. I want to go home, Astrid insisted, getting out of the bed.
The minute they arrived home, Astrid put into motion the plan she had spent the past 2 days devising. She went into the kitchen and gave the cook and the maid the day off. Then she instructed Evangeline to take Cassian to play at the beach house in Tanamera. Michael was surprised by the sudden flurry of activity, but he assumed that Astrid just wanted some peace and quiet for the rest of the day. As soon as everyone was out of the flat and Astrid heard the elevator door shut, she fixed her gaze on Michael. They were completely alone now, and she could suddenly hear her heartbeat fill her eardrums. She knew that if she didn't say the word she had carefully rehearsed in her head right now, she would lose her nerve.
Michael, I want you to know what happened on Friday night, she began.
You already told me, Astrid. It doesn't matter. I'm just glad that you and Cassian are okay, Michael said.
No, no, Astrid said. I want you to know the real reason I got into the car wreck.
What are you talking about? Michael asked, confused.
I'm talking about how I became so distracted that I almost got our son killed, Astrid said, a note of anger hanging in her voice. It was my fault. It was far too late and too dark, especially those narrow lanes around the botanic gardens. I shouldn't have been driving, but I was, and all I could think about was where you were and what you were doing.
What do you mean? I was home, Michael said matter-of-factly. What were you so worried about?
Astrid took a deep breath, and before she could stop herself, the words came tumbling out.
I know you think I'm some sort of delicate creature, but I'm a lot tougher than you think. I need you to be honest with me, completely honest. I saw a text message on your phone last month, Michael. The dirty one. I know you've been in Hong Kong when you were supposed to be in northern China. I found your dinner receipt from Petrus. And I know all about the charm bracelet you bought from Stephen Chia.
Michael sat down, the color draining from his face. Astrid watched him slump into the sofa, his body language speaking volumes.
He was guilty as hell.
She felt a surge of confidence that compelled her to ask the question she never imagined she would ever ask.
Have you been? Are you having an affair?
Michael sighed and shook his head almost imperceptibly.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry to have hurt you and Cassian.
You're right. The car accident was my fault.
Just tell me everything, Michael, and I will try to understand, Astrid said softly, sitting down on the ottoman across from him, a calmness coming over her. No more lies, Michael. Tell me, who is this woman you've been seeing?
Michael could not bring himself to look up at his wife. He knew the time had finally come to say what he had been struggling to say for so long.
I'm so sorry, Astrid. I don't want to cause you any more pain. I'll go.
Astrid looked at him in surprise.
Michael, I'm asking you to tell me what happened. I want to know everything so we can put this all behind us.
Michael got up from the sofa abruptly.
I don't know if that's possible.
Why not?
Michael turned away from Astrid and stared past the sliding glass doors of the balcony. He stared out at the trees lining Cavanaugh Road, looking like giant bushy stalks of broccoli from up here. The trees marked the perimeter of the grounds that surrounded Istana, and beyond that, Fort Canning Park, River Valley Road, and then the Singapore River. He wished he had the power to fly off the balcony, to fly toward the river and away from this pain.
I've hurt you too much, and now I don't know if I can stop myself from hurting you even more, he finally said.
Astrid was silent for a moment, trying to decipher what he meant.
Is it because you're in love with this woman? She asked, her eyes brimming with tears. Or is it because you had another child with her?
Michael smiled mysteriously.
What? Does your father have me under surveillance or something?
Don't be ridiculous. A friend just happened to see you in Hong Kong, that's all. Who is the boy, and who is this woman you've been seeing?
Astrid, the boy and the woman are beside the point. You and I...
It isn't working for us anymore. It hasn't really ever worked.
We've just been pretending it has,
Michael said emphatically, feeling that these were his first truly honest words to her in a very long time. Astrid stared at him, stunned.
How can you say that?
Well, you want me to be honest, so I'm being honest. Your father was right. I haven't been doing my duty as a husband. I have been too consumed with my job, working my ass off, trying to get this company off the ground. And you are consumed by your family obligations and traveling around the world 50 times a year. What kind of marriage do we have? We're not happy, Michael declared.
I can't believe I'm hearing this. I've been happy. I was very happy until the day I discovered that damn text message,
Astrid insisted, getting up and pacing around the room.
Are you sure about that? Are you sure you've truly been happy? I think you're deceiving yourself, Astrid.
I see what you're doing, Michael. You're just trying to find an easy way out of this. You're trying to blame me to make this all about me when you're the one who's guilty.
Look, I'm not the one who broke our wedding vows. I'm not the one who cheated.
Astrid seethed, her shock transforming into rage.
Okay, I'm guilty. I admit it. I admit that I am a cheater. Happy now?
I'm not happy, and it will take me some time, but I'll learn to deal with it,
Astrid said matter-of-factly.
Well, I can't deal with it anymore, Michael moaned. So I'm going to pack.
What's all this packing business? Who's asking you to leave? Do you think I want to kick you out of the house just because you cheated on me? Do you think I'm that simple-minded that I think I'm the first woman whose husband ever had an affair?
I'm not going anywhere, Michael. I'm standing right here, trying to work through this with you, for the sake of our marriage, for the sake of our son.
Astrid, when have you ever really done anything for the sake of your son? I think Cassian will be much better off growing up with two parents who are happy rather than with parents who are trapped in a bad marriage,
Michael argued. Astrid was perplexed. Who was this man standing in front of her? Where had he suddenly procured all this psychobabble?
It's because of that woman, isn't it? I see. You don't want to be part of this family anymore. You want to live with this whore, don't you? She cried.
Michael took a deep breath before answering.
Yes, I don't want to live with you anymore. And I think that for both our sakes, I should move out today.
He knew that if he was ever going to leave, this was his chance. He began to walk toward the bedroom. Where was his large suitcase? Astrid stood helplessly by the doorway to the bedroom, wondering what had just happened. This was not how it was supposed to go. She watched numbly as Michael began to grab his clothes and throw them haphazardly into his black Tumi suitcase. She had wanted to buy him a suite of Loewe luggage when they were in Barcelona last year, but he insisted on something cheaper and more practical. Now she had the distinct feeling of being trapped in a dream. None of this could really be happening. The fight they just had? The car accident? Michael's philandering? None of it. Her husband wasn't really leaving. There was no way he was leaving. This was just a nightmare. She hugged herself, pinching the flesh around her elbow repeatedly, willing herself to wake up.
Chapter 15. Nick. Macau. Nick ran his fingers along the leather-bound spines perfectly arranged on the neoclassical mahogany bookcase. Lieutenant Hornblower, Islands in the Stream, Billy Budd, all nautical-themed titles. He picked out a volume by Knut Hamsun that he had never heard of, August, and settled into one of the overstuffed club chairs, hoping he would be undisturbed for a while. Cracking open the stiff embossed cover, he could tell at once that its pages, like most of the others here, had probably never seen the light of day. Hardly surprising, considering that this sumptuous library was tucked away on the lower deck of a 388-foot yacht that boasted such distractions as a ballroom, a karaoke lounge for Bernard's dad, a chapel for his mother, a casino, a sushi bar complete with a full-time sushi chef from Hokkaido, two swimming pools, and an outdoor bowling alley on the uppermost deck that also converted into a runway for fashion shows. Nick glanced at the door in dismay as footsteps could be heard coming down the spiral staircase just outside the library. If he'd been smarter, he would have locked the door behind him. Much to Nick's relief, it was Mehmet who peered in.
Nicholas Young, why am I not surprised to find you in the only intellectually inclined room on this entire vessel? Mehmet remarked. Mind if I join you? This looks to be the quietest place on the boat, and if I have to hear another Hotel Coast remix, I think I'm going to jump overboard and swim for the nearest buoy. You're most welcome here. How are the natives doing? Incredibly restless, I would say. I left the pool deck just as the ice cream sundae contest began. They're making sundaes, Nick cocked an eyebrow. Yes, on a dozen nude Macanese girls. Nick shook his head wearily. I tried to rescue Colin, but he got trapped. Bernard anointed Colin the whipped cream king. Mehmet slouched into a club chair and closed his eyes. Colin should have listened to me and come to Istanbul for a relaxing getaway before the wedding. I told him to invite you, too. Now that would have been nice, Nick smiled. I would much rather be at your family's summer palace on the banks of the Bosporus than on this boat. You know, I'm surprised Colin had a bachelor party in the first place. It didn't strike me as his sort of thing. It's not, but I think Colin felt like he couldn't refuse Bernard, what with Bernard's father being the largest minority shareholder in the coup organization, Nick explained. Bernard's doing a fine job, isn't he? He truly thinks Colin enjoys being part of the biggest drug and drinking binge I've witnessed since spring break in Cabo, Mehmet murmured. Nick stared at him in surprise, never expecting to hear those words come out of Mehmet's mouth. Mehmet opened one eye and grinned. Just kidding. I've never been to Cabo. I just always wanted to say that. You scared me for a second, Nick laughed. Just then, Colin stumbled into the library and plopped down on the nearest chair.
God help me. I don't think I'll ever be able to eat another maraschino cherry again.
He moaned, massaging his temples.
Colin, did you actually eat off one of the girls? Mehmet asked incredulously.
No. Araminta would kill me if she found out I ate a hot fudge sundae off some girl's crotch. I only took one cherry, and then I told Bernard I really needed to go to the bathroom.
Where did all these girls come from in the first place? Mehmet asked.
Bernard hired them from that brothel he forced all of us to go to last night, Colin mumbled through his pounding headache.
You know, I think he was genuinely shocked when we turned down the girls he had procured for the night, Mehmet remarked.
Poor bastard. We've completely ruined his bachelor weekend, haven't we? We didn't want to go to the dogfights, we didn't want to make sex videos with prostitutes, and we turned up our noses at his fancy Peruvian cocaine. Nick laughed.
Screams could be heard from the upper deck, followed by much panicked yelling.
I wonder what's happening now, Nick said.
But none of them could muster up the effort to get out of the plush club chairs. The yacht began to slow, and several crewmen could be heard running along the lower decks. Alistair strolled into the room, carefully balancing a white cup and saucer with what appeared to be a very frothy cappuccino.
"What's all the screaming on the deck?" Colin asked with a groan.
Alistair simply rolled his eyes and sat down in one of the chairs by the Regency drum table.
"One of the girls slipped overboard during the oil wrestling contest. Not to worry, her breasts make an excellent flotation device."
He began sipping his coffee, but then made a face.
"The Aussie bartender lied to me. He told me he could make the perfect flat white, and this isn't even close. This is just a lousy latte."
"What is a flat white?" Mehmet asked.
"It's a kind of cappuccino they only do down in Oz. You use the steam frothy milk from the bottom of the jug, holding back the foam at the top so that you get this smooth, velvety texture."
"And that's good?" Mehmet continued, a little intrigued.
"Oh, it's the best. I had to have at least two a day back in my uni days in Sydney," Alistair said. "God, now I'm craving one too," Colin sighed. "This is a fucking nightmare. I just wish we could get off this boat and go have a decent cup of coffee somewhere. I know this is supposed to be one of the coolest new yachts in the world, and I should be so grateful, but frankly, it feels like a floating prison to me."
His face darkened, and Nick looked at him uneasily. Nick could sense that Colin was slipping fast into one of his deep funks. An idea began to take shape in his head. He whipped out his cell phone and began scrolling through his contacts, leaning over to Mehmet and whispering in his ear. Mehmet grinned and nodded eagerly.
"What are the two of you whispering about?" Alistair asked, leaning over curiously.
"I just had an idea. Colin, are you ready to bail out of this pathetically lame bachelor party?" Nick asked. "I would like nothing more, but I don't think I can risk offending Bernard and, more important, his father. I mean, Bernard pulled out all the stops to entertain us in grand style this weekend." "Actually, Bernard pulled out all the stops to entertain himself," Nick retorted. "Look how miserable you are. How much more of this do you want to endure, just so the ties won't be offended? It's your last weekend as a single man, Colin. I think I have an exit strategy that won't offend anyone. If I can make it happen, will you play along?"
"Okay, why not?" Colin said a little trepidatiously. "Hear, hear," Alistair cheered.
"Quick, quick, we have a medical emergency. I need you to stop this boat and I need our precise coordinates right now," Nick demanded as he rushed into the yacht's pilot house. "What's the matter?" the captain asked. "My friend is suffering from acute pancreatitis. We have a doctor below who thinks he might have begun bleeding internally. I'm on the line with the Life Flight Rescue Chopper," Nick said, holding up his cell phone anxiously. "Wait a minute. Just wait a minute. I'm the captain of the ship. I'm the one who decides whether we call for medical evacuations. Who's the doctor below? Let me go see the patient," the captain gruffly demanded. "Captain, with all due respect, we don't have a moment to waste. You can come look at him all you want, but right now, I just need the coordinates from you." "But who are you speaking to? Macau? Coast Guard? This is highly irregular protocol. Let me talk to them," the captain sputtered in confusion. Nick put on his most condescendingly posh accent, honed from all his years at Balio, and glowered at the captain. "Do you have any idea who my friend is? He is Colin Koo, heir to one of the biggest fortunes on the planet. Don't get snooty with me, young chap," the captain bellowed. "I don't care who your friend is. There are maritime emergency protocols I must follow, and right now my friend is below deck on your ship, quite possibly hemorrhaging to death, because you won't let me call for an emergency evacuation," Nick interrupted, raising his voice to match the captain's. "Do you want to take the blame for this? Because you will. I can guarantee that. I'm Nicholas Young, and my family controls one of the world's largest shipping conglomerates. Please, just give me the fucking coordinates now, or I promise you I'll personally see to it that you won't even be able to captain a piece of styrofoam after today."
20 minutes later, as Bernard sat in the diamond-shaped jacuzzi on the uppermost deck, while a half-Portuguese girl tried to swallow both of his testicles under the bubbly water jets, a white Sikorsky helicopter appeared out of the sky and began to descend onto the yacht's helipad. At first, he thought he was hallucinating from all the booze. Then he saw Nick, Mehmet, and Alistair emerge onto the helipad, holding a stretcher on which lay Colin, tightly bundled up in one of the yacht's silk etro blankets.
"What the fuck is happening?" he said, getting out of the water, pulling on his Villebrequin trunks, and rushing up the steps toward the helipad.
He ran into Lionel in the corridor.
"I was just coming to tell you, Colin is feeling horribly sick. He's been doubled over in pain for the past hour and throwing up uncontrollably. We think it's alcohol poisoning from all of his boozing over the past 2 days. We're getting him off the boat and straight to the hospital."
They ran to the helicopter and Bernard looked in at Colin, who was groaning softly, his face locked in a grimace. Alistair sat beside him, mopping his forehead with a damp towel.
"Why the hell didn't anyone tell me sooner? I had no idea Colin was feeling this sick." "Canina! Now your family is going to blame me, and then it's going to get into all the gossip columns, all the papers,"
Bernard complained, suddenly becoming alarmed.
"Nothing is going to leak. No gossip, no newspapers," Lionel said solemnly. "Colin doesn't want you to get any blame, which is why you have to listen to me now. We're going to take him to the hospital, and we won't tell anyone in the family what's happening. I've had alcohol poisoning before. Colin just needs to get detoxed and rehydrated. He'll be fine in a few days. You and the other guys need to keep pretending that nothing's wrong and keep partying, okay?
Don't call the family, don't say a word to anyone, and we'll see you back in Singapore.
Okay, okay. Bernard nodded rapidly, feeling relieved. Now he could get back to his blowjob without feeling guilty.
As the helicopter lifted off from the yacht, Nick and Alistair began laughing uncontrollably at the figure of Bernard, his baggy swimming trunks whipping around his pale, damp thighs, staring up at them in bewilderment.
I don't think it even occurred to him that this isn't a medical helicopter, but a chartered one, Mehmet chuckled.
Where are we going? Colin asked excitedly, throwing off the purple and gold paisley blanket.
Mehmet and I have chartered a Cessna Citation 10. It's all fueled up and waiting for us in Hong Kong. From there, it's a surprise, Nick said.
The Citation 10? Isn't that the plane that flies at 600 miles per hour? Alistair asked.
It's even faster when we're just five people with no luggage, Nick grinned.
A mere 6 hours later, Nick, Colin, Alistair, Mehmet, and Lionel found themselves sitting on canvas chairs in the middle of the Australian desert, taking in the spectacular view of the glowing rock.
I've always wanted to come to Ayers Rock, or Uluru, or whatever they call it now, Colin said.
It's so quiet, Mehmet said softly. This is a very spiritual place, isn't it? I can really feel its energy, even from this distance.
It's considered to be the most sacred site for the Aboriginal tribes, Nick answered. My father brought me here years ago. Back in those days, we were still allowed to climb the rock. They stopped letting you do that a few years ago.
Guys, I can't thank you enough. This was the perfect escape from a very misguided bachelor party. I'm sorry I put all of you through Bernard's bullshit. This is really all I ever hoped for, to be someplace amazing with my best friends.
A man in a white polo shirt and khaki shorts approached with a large tray from the luxury eco-resort nearby.
Well, Colin, Alistair, I thought that the only way to get you coffee stops to stop bitching and moaning was to get you a decent flat white, 100% made in Australia, Nick said as the waiter put the tray down on the reddish earth.
Alistair brought the cup to his nose and inhaled the rich aroma deeply.
Nick, if you weren't my cousin, I'd kiss you right now, he joked.
Colin took a long sip of his coffee, its perfect velvety foam leaving a white frothy mustache on his upper lip.
This has got to be the best coffee I've ever tasted. Guys, I'll never forget this.
It was just past sunset, and the sky was shifting rapidly from shades of burnt orange into a deep violet blue. The men sat in awed silence as the world's largest monolith glowed and shimmered a thousand indescribable shades of crimson. Chapter 16. Dr. Gu, Singapore. Wai Moon sat at his desk studying the piece of paper his daughter had just handed him. The ornate desk was a replica of the one Napoleon used at the Tuileries, with a satinwood veneer and ormolu legs of lions' heads and torsos that descended into elaborate claws. Wai Moon loved to sit in his burgundy velvet empire chair and rub his socked feet against the bulbous golden claws, a habit his wife constantly scolded him for. Today, it was Paik Lin who substituted for her mother.
Dad, you're going to rub off all the gold if you don't stop doing that.
Wai Moon ignored her and kept scratching his toes compulsively. He stared at the names Paik Lin had written down during her phone conversation a few days ago with Rachel. James Young, Rosemary Tien, Oliver Tien, Jacqueline Ling. Who were these people behind that mysterious old gate on Tyersall Road? Not recognizing any of these names bothered him more than he was willing to admit. Wai Moon couldn't help but remember what his father always said.
Never forget, we are Hainanese, son. We are the descendants of servants and seamen. We always have to work harder to prove our worth.
Even from a young age, Wai Moon had been made aware that being the Chinese-educated son of a Hainanese immigrant put him at a disadvantage to the aristocratic Straits Chinese landowners or the Hokkiens that dominated the banking industry. His father had come to Singapore as a 14-year-old laborer and built a construction business out of sheer sweat and tenacity, and as their family business blossomed over the decades into a far-flung empire, why Moon thought that he had leveled the playing field. Singapore was a meritocracy, and whoever performed well was invited into the winner's circle. But those people behind the gates, were a sudden reminder that this was not entirely the case. With his children all grown up now, it was time for the next generation to keep conquering new territory. His eldest son, Pick Wing, had done well by marrying the daughter of a junior MP, a Cantonese girl who was brought up a Christian, no less. PT was still fooling around and enjoying his playboy ways, so the focus now was on Pick Lin. Out of his three children, Pick Lin took after him the most. She was his smartest, most ambitious, and, dare he admit it, most attractive child. She was the one he felt confident would surpass all of them and make a truly brilliant match, linking the Goes with one of Singapore's blue-blooded families. He could sense from the way his daughter spoke that she was onto something, and he was determined to help her dig deeper.
"I think it's time we paid a visit to Dr. Gu," he said to his daughter.
Dr. Gu was a retired doctor in his late 80s, an eccentric who lived alone in a small, dilapidated house at the bottom of Dunyan Road. He was born in Chian to a family of scholars, but moved to Singapore in his youth for schooling. In the natural order of how Singapore society worked, Wai Moon and Dr. Gu might never have crossed paths had it not been for Dr. Gu's maddening stubbornness some 30-odd years ago. Go Developments had been building a new complex of semi-detached houses along Dunyan Road, and Dr. Gu's little plot of land was the sole obstruction to the project getting underway. His neighbors had been bought out under extremely favorable terms, but Dr. Gu refused to budge. After all of his lawyers had failed in their negotiations, Wai Moon drove to the house himself, armed with his checkbook and determined to talk some sense into the old fart. Instead, the brilliant old curmudgeon convinced him to alter his entire scheme, and the revised development turned out to be even more of a success because of his recommendations. Wai Moon now found himself visiting his new friend to offer him a job. Dr. Gu refused, but Wai Moon would keep coming back, enthralled by Dr. Gu's encyclopedic knowledge of Singapore history, his acute analysis of the financial markets, and his wonderful Longjing tea. Wai Moon and Pick Lin drove over to Dr. Gu's house, parking Wai Moon's shiny new Maserati Quattro Porte just outside the rust-corroded metal gate.
"I can't believe he still lives here," Pick Lin said as they walked down the cracked cement driveway. "Shouldn't he be in a retirement home by now?" "I think he manages okay. He has a maid and also two daughters, you know," Wai Moon said.
"He was smart not to sell out to you 30 years ago. This little piece of land is worth even more of a fortune now. It's the last undeveloped plot on Dunyan Road. We can probably even build a very sleek, narrow apartment tower here," Pick Lin commented.
"I tell you, La, he intends to die in this shack. Did I tell you what I heard from my stockbroker, Mr. Ui, many years ago? Dr. Gu is sitting on 1 million shares of HSBC.
"What?"
Pick Lin turned to her father in amazed shock.
1 million shares? That's more than 50 million in today's dollars. He started buying HSBC shares in the 40s. I heard this tidbit 20 years ago, and the stock has split how many times since then? I tell you, old Dr. Gu is worth hundreds of millions by now.
Pick Lin stared with renewed wonder as the man with the shock of unruly white hair came hobbling out onto his porch in a brown polyester short-sleeved shirt that looked like it had been tailored in pre-Castro Havana and a pair of dark green pajama bottoms.
"Go, Wai Moon! Still wasting money on expensive cars, I see," he bellowed, his voice surprisingly robust for a man of his age.
"Greetings, Dr. Gu. Do you remember my daughter, Pick Lin?"
Wai Moon said, patting the old man on the back.
Is this your daughter? I thought this pretty girl must surely be your latest mistress. I know how all you property tycoons are."
Pick Lin laughed.
"Hello, Dr. Gu. My father wouldn't be standing here if I was his mistress. My mom would castrate him."
"Oh, but I thought she did that a long time ago already."
Everyone laughed as Dr. Gu led them to a few wooden chairs arranged in a small front garden. Pick Lin noticed that the grass was meticulously mowed and edged. The fence that fronted Dunyan Road was covered in thick intertwining vines of morning glories, skirting the bucolic little patch from the traffic along the busy thoroughfare. There isn't a single place like this left along this entire stretch, Paiklin thought. An elderly Chinese servant came out of the house with a large round wooden tray. On it was a ceramic teapot, an old copper kettle, three clay teacups, and three smaller snifter cups. Dr. Gu held the well-burnished kettle high above the teapot and began pouring.
I love watching Dr. Gu do his tea ritual, Wai Moon said to his daughter quietly.
See how he pours the water from high up? This is known as Shan Hu Gao Chong, rinsing from an elevated pot.
Then Dr. Gu began to pour the tea into each of the three cups, but instead of offering it to his guests, he flung the light caramel-colored tea dramatically from each cup onto the grass behind him, much to Paiklin's surprise. He then refilled the teapot with a fresh batch of hot water.
See, Paiklin, that was the first rinse of the leaves, known as Hang Yun Yu Shui, a row of clouds, running water. This second pouring from a lower height is called Zai Zu Qing Xuan. Direct again the pure spring, Wai Moon continued.
Wai Moon, she could probably care less about these old proverbs, Dr. Gu said, before launching into a clinically precise explanation.
The first pouring was done from a height so that the force of water rinses the Longjing leaves. The hot water also helps to acclimate the temperature of the teapot and the cups. Then you do a second pouring, this time slowly and near the mouth of the pot, to gently coax the flavor out of the leaves. Now, we let it steep for a while.
The sound of screeching truck brakes just beyond the fence interrupted the serenity of Dr. Gu's tea ritual.
Doesn't all this noise bother you? Paiklin asked.
Not at all. It reminds me that I am still alive and that my hearing is not deteriorating as quickly as I had planned, Dr. Gu replied.
Sometimes I wish I didn't have to hear all the nonsense that comes out of politicians' mouths.
Come on, La, Dr. Gu, if it weren't for our politicians, do you think you would be able to enjoy this nice garden of yours? Think of how they've transformed this place from a backward island to one of the most prosperous countries in the world,
Wai Moon argued, always on the defensive whenever anyone criticized the government.
What rubbish! Prosperity is nothing but an illusion. Do you know what my children are doing with all this prosperity? My eldest daughter started a dolphin research institute. She is determined to rescue the white dolphins of the Yangtze River from extinction. Do you know how polluted that river is? This bloody mammal is already extinct. Scientists haven't been able to locate a single one of these creatures for years now, but she is determined to find them. And my other daughter? She buys old castles in Scotland. Not even the Scottish want those crumbling old pits, but my daughter does. She spends millions restoring them, and then no one comes to visit her. Her wastrel son, my only grandson and namesake, is 36 years old. Do you want to know what he does?
No, I mean, yes, Paiklin said, trying not to giggle.
He has a rock and roll band in London. Not even like those Beatles who at least made money. This one has long, oily hair, wears black eyeliner, and makes horrible noises with home appliances.
Well, at least they are being creative, Paiklin offered politely.
Creatively wasting all my hard-earned money. I'm telling you, this so-called prosperity is going to be the downfall of Asia. Each new generation becomes lazier than the next. They think they can make overnight fortunes just by flipping properties and getting hot tips in the stock market. Ha! Nothing lasts forever, and when this boom ends, these youngsters won't know what hit them. This is why I force my kids to work for a living. They are not going to get a single cent out of me until I am 6 feet underground, Wai Moon said, winking at his daughter.
Dr. Gu peeked into the teapot, finally satisfied with the brew. He poured the tea into the snifter cups.
Now, this is called Long Fen Cheng Shang, which means the dragon and phoenix, foretells good fortune, he said,
placing a teacup over the smaller snifter cup and inverting the cups deftly, releasing the tea into the drinking cup. He presented the first cup to Wai Moon and the second cup to Paiklin. She thanked him and took her first sip. The tea was bracingly bitter, and she tried not to make a face while swallowing it.
So, Wai Moon, what really brings you here today?
Surely you didn't come to hear an old man rant.
Dr. Gu eyed Paik Lin.
Your father is very cunning, you know.
He only comes calling when he needs to get something out of me.
Dr. Gu, your roots go deep in Singapore. Tell me.
Have you ever heard of James Young? Wai Moon asked, cutting to the chase. Dr. Gu looked up from pouring his own tea with a start.
James Young? I haven't heard anyone utter that name in decades. Do you know him, then? I met his grandson recently. He's dating a good friend of mine,
Paik Lin explained. She took another sip of the tea, finding herself appreciating its silky bitterness more and more with each sip.
Who are the Youngs?
Wai Moon asked eagerly.
Why are you suddenly so interested in these people?
Dr. Gu queried. Wai Moon considered the question carefully before he answered.
We are trying to help my daughter's friend, since she is quite serious about the boy. I am not familiar with the family.
Of course you wouldn't know them, Wai Moon. Hardly anybody does these days.
I have to admit that my own knowledge is very outdated.
Well, what can you tell us?
Wai Moon pressed on. Dr. Gu took a long sip of his tea and leaned into a more comfortable position.
The Youngs are descended, I believe, from a long line of royal court physicians, going all the way back to the Tang Dynasty. James Young, Sir James Young, actually, was the first Western-educated neurologist in Singapore, trained at Oxford.
He made his fortune as a doctor?
Wai Moon asked, rather surprised.
Not at all. James was not the sort of person who cared about making a fortune. He was too busy saving lives in World War II during the Japanese occupation,
Dr. Gu said, staring at the crisscrossing patterns of ivy on his fence as they suddenly seemed to transform into diamond-like patterns, reminding him of a chain-link fence from a long time ago.
So you knew him during the war?
Wai Moon asked, jarring Dr. Gu out of his recollection.
Yes, yes, that's how I knew him,
Dr. Gu said slowly. He hesitated for a few moments before continuing.
James Young was in charge of an underground medical corps that I was briefly involved with. After the war, he set up his clinic in the old section of Chinatown, specifically to serve the poor and elderly. I heard that for years he charged his patients practically nothing.
So how did he make his money?
There you go again, Wai Moon, always chasing after the money, Dr. Gu chided.
Well, where did that huge house come from?
Wai Moon asked.
Ah, I see the true nature of your interest now. You must be referring to the house off Tyersall Road.
Yes. Have you been there?
Paik Lin asked.
Goodness, no. I only heard about it. Like I said, I really did not know James very well. I would never have been invited.
I dropped my friend off at the house last week, and I could hardly believe it when I saw the place.
You must be joking. Is the house still there?
Dr. Gu said, looking quite shocked.
Yes, Paik Lin replied.
I would have thought that the place was long gone. I must say, I'm quite impressed that the family never sold out in all these years.
Yes, I'm quite shocked that there's a property this large on the island,
Wai Moon cut in.
Why should you be? The whole area behind the botanic gardens used to be full of great estates. The Sultan of Johor had a palace over there called Istana Woodnik that burned to the ground many years ago.
You say you were there last week?
Dr. Gu queried.
Yes, but I did not go in.
A pity. It would be a rare treat to see one of those houses.
So few are left, thanks to all the brilliant developers,
Dr. Gu said, glaring in mock anger at Wai Moon.
So, if James Young never made any money, how did
Wai Moon begin?
You don't listen, Wai Moon. I said that James Young wasn't interested in making money, but I never said he didn't have any.
The Youngs had money, generations of money. Besides, James married Shang Suyi, and she, I can tell you for a fact, comes from a family so unfathomably rich. It would make your eyes water, Wai Moon.
Who is she, then?
Wai Moon asked, his curiosity piqued to boiling point.
All right, I will tell you and shut you up once and for all. She is the daughter of Shang Lung Ma. Never heard that name either, right? He was an enormously wealthy banker in Peking, and before the Qing Dynasty fell, he very smartly moved his money to Singapore, where he made an even greater fortune in shipping and commodities. The man had his tentacles in every major business in the region. He controlled all the shipping lines from the Dutch East Indies to Siam, and he was the mastermind behind uniting the early Hokkien banks in the 30s.
So Nick's grandmother inherited all of that, Picklin surmised.
She and her brother Alfred.
Alfred Chang.